top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here is episode 382 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Censor from 2021. Now, as it just so happens, this is a female-directed production by Prano Bailey Bond. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And it comes on the heels of me just sort of mulling over different possible inclusions I may have for my favorite horror films directed by women. Came up with, I think, a pretty decent list. I mean, you have to have Mary Harron's exemplary, freaking awesome, one of the top 50 horrors of all time, which would be American Psycho, and I would say a very, very strong candidate to be the best horror film of the 2000s, although you could probably make a very solid case for some of the French New Wave horrors that came like 5 or 6 years later. I think that would be very fair. So the rest of my list included the Soska Sisters, very compelling and unique, small, contained movie, American Mary, though I gotta admit I did not warm to their recent rabid reboot, particularly. I also quite liked Karen Kusama's, or is it Kusama? I'm not sure. She did Jennifer's Body, but she also did The Invitation, which I thought was really interesting, and I wasn't even sure if I would be able to get into it based on the plot description alone, but gladly I was proven wrong, and that movie took a lot of twists and turns, and for a dinner party setup, things went horribly awry, and I thought that was a very, very cool movie. Barbara Peters co-directed Humanoids from the Deep, the 1980s. Creature feature that I really, really like too. It's just very, very trashy and extremely sleazy. So those were some of my candidates. You got to throw in Near Dark as well in that mix. But when you have this one, when I was reading the description about how this is a period piece about, of all eras, the video nasty moral panic that occurred in the UK roughly around the time of, I want to say probably the late 70s, early 80s. It probably happened a little bit well into the 80s when it was really starting to boom, and strangely and paradoxically at the time the horror boom was going bust, shall we say. It would have been, let's say, mid 80s or something, and I couldn't help but notice right off the bat that Censor bears some sort of superficial similarities to Videodrome, but more recently, I think, The Editor, in which a film editor becomes enveloped and enmeshed in this in the horror space by going far too down the rabbit hole for the films that he's in. It's kind of a neat idea when you think about it, because when you figure the character of Enid in the Censor film, and she's played by, I hope I'm getting this right, Niamh Algar, she is kind of a very uptight and prim and proper woman who works for the British Board of Film Classification, and that would have been the body responsible for making these very subjective judgments on what constitutes overly violent materials and what would necessitate an R rating. And you would think, like, doing this job, you'd either go off the deep end, or you would become incredibly inured to just the carnage that you face on a day-to-day basis. And you can't help but think probably the former more than the latter would happen, but it's an interesting idea. And when you think about it too, both Jeff and I, well, I got into horror much earlier, and then Jeff eclipsed me with his viewing habits, but I started when I was 12 watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Night of the Living Dead and whatnot, and have seen, it has to be hundreds and hundreds of horror films. I've, too many to count, really. I mean, if you just include movies with the title Dead in them, like Video Dead and Brain Dead and Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Dead Ringers, and I probably have 100 movies with just Dead in the title. So yeah, I'm really into this. And as a metaphor for how your psychology can be altered by the repeated viewings of these types of films is put into sharp focus by having a character whose actual job it is to subject themselves to these horrors. It reminds me a little bit of a documentary I saw, apologies, the name escapes me, about some of the South Asian workers that Facebook tasked with this very unenviable job of combing through social media posts for stuff that would in the 70s or 80s be referred to as snuff. And maybe that term is used still to this day, I'm not sure. But this film, Censor, really draws on these types of things. And there's some quite good examples, fictional ones, of the type of film that would have made its way onto the Video Nasties list. So this was a moral panic that included all sorts of films that fell under its rubric, some of which were maybe possibly deserving, largely though most were not. And in the film here, there's a fictional Don't Go in the Church, which is sort of a variant on one of the Nasties of, I think it was Don't Go in the House or Don't Answer the Phone or one of these types of things. Jeff and I have covered it quite a bit, and it's quite a unique conceit to film a horror film that is, well, it's more of a psychodrama, I guess you would call it, about censorship, given that I think possibly you could say that moral panic, while it went too far in the past, the pendulum could have swung the other way far too much, because we've yet to tell, and the jury is still out, the extent to which our engagement in and envelopment through social media is causing a profound and long-lasting and very deleterious impact to our brains. So people have also called out the highly engaging and interactive nature of, let's say, first-person shooter, although there's no real hard evidence. It's just conjectural at this point and associative and not causal, I guess, the link between violent video games and acts of violence, and I don't think they'll ever find anything much like in the horror space. So it just strikes me now that there's very little in the way of any moral, if you want to call it that, little of any oversight that can, when it comes to getting youngsters to prevent youngsters from engaging and interfacing with this kind of material. And I've talked at length about how in Toronto growing up, there's Korean corner stores and variety stores, as we call them, bodegas or whatever, where you could rent virtually anything. But that also was a two-way street, because it required someone who had the balls to try several times to be able to rent materials that were that were not at their age threshold. So it took a lot of work to track down these kinds of films, and whereas right now you can just go anywhere and see just about anything, and we haven't even touched on the dark web and all the sinister things that lurk beneath that. So yeah, yes, I think it's got to be extremely challenging to be a youngster right now and having to have all these kinds of images right in your face and so easily accessible, and you can't help but be, I guess, immune or inured to these things. And when you have the value of hindsight and growing up in the horror space for decades, and you look at, see what kind of response, let's say, Gen Z types level at some of the quintessential horrors that have really shaken people in the past, it makes you wonder what will, going forward, be the kind of thing that shakes people to their foundation 20 years from now. It's pretty amazing. As an aside, I was watching this Netflix show, and I promise we'll get back to a censor, but I was watching this next Netflix show called Casual, and it's about a 40-year-old mother of one who is compelled to, through financial circumstances, move in with her younger brother. And it follows, as the title would suggest, their escapades and the dating scene and whatnot. And I was kind of shocked to see just how cavalierly they depicted a teenage threesome. So this one woman who's the star of the show is a 16-year-old daughter who not only was actively Nabokov Lolita style in, well, reversing the genders, but actively going after her boss, a female boss, but also her high school photography teacher, and also attending parties that were for college-age students. And it's a type of thing that would really, it would give you pause as a parent, one would have hoped, although the way it was depicted in this show, albeit a comedy, was a thorough lack of concern by the parent, and it was something that was quite shocking to me. So it's going to be interesting what passes for entertainment again when we look 2 decades into the future. Now, Censor, as a film, incorporates some real-life nasties as well. I think I recognize an axe-wielding scene from A Nightmare in a Damaged Brain, but there's also, I think this one fell into the public domain space of the infamous Driller Killer, and that made its way onto the list as well. So you follow this Enid character, and she has a backstory that involves the disappearance of her sister Nina when she was little, and Nina is coming to life and being, reimagined, through the exploitation films of this one fictional director, Frederick North, who it would have been like whose violent films were notorious. He would probably be kind of a Brit version of Ruggero Deodato or Umberto Lenzi or one of these characters. It's one of these guys, like, he's a director of these films that Enid has been tasked to go through. And she's approached by Doug, who's a film producer who works for Mr. North, and hits on Enid, and as was par for the course at the time, when before the Me Too movement and all that, and workplace politics was a lot less of a complex entity than it is today. But Enid finds herself overcome with this "Don't Go in the Church" production that she has a hard time first doing her job with, sort of dangle a participle there, but she has a difficult time being able to find out and suss out which parts to snip as part of her 9-to-5 job, and she's overcome with nausea and she can't handle it, and it's sort of conjuring up memories of her sister's disappearance, and this is something that's puts her at loggerheads with her parents, because her parents have metaphorically at least buried Nina and just really declared her dead, whereas Enid is pretty insistent through films like the ones that she's interfacing with, much like the editor, that there's something on the other side, and that the one of the film's leads is not Alice Lee, but actually Enid's sister Nina, and this film sort of follows this path, and you have aesthetically it calls out elements of Dario Argento, and there's a certain kinds of hues, and it's imbued with these kinds of pinks, and it should be said that the fictional exploitation films, the nasties in this case, they actually look pretty good. And Don't Go in the Church is a kind of supernatural bloodfest, the kind of thing that I would probably seek out if I were around at the time, and hell, do now. It's well done. And although I think this one, we're going to segue into what we've learned, this one has, I think, is hampered a little bit by a certain sluggishness. And I think given the subject matter, it could have stood to have a little bit more uber violence, given, again, this, you say what you will about the video nasties, some of them were super, super violent, and others not so much, but just because of a title, they were lumped in, and people didn't want to lose their jobs, especially government bureaucrats, by making the wrong decisions. So I think they could have gone hard with the exploitation side of things. I really did like, it's another thing I've learned too, I really like the depiction and the more muted depiction of the 80s, because Censor is a film that doesn't, you know, draw out from a visual standpoint the 80s in all caps of this big hair and the shoulder pads and all this. It's more of a subdued kind of feel, and it's something that I really appreciated similarly in a film I just saw, Paul Thomas Anderson's Licorice Pizza, a terrible title. That one stars one of the, I guess all three members of this band, Haim, are in it, but Alana Haim is the eponymous star, plays Alana in that one. And that's a 70s period piece where, apart from the hairstyle and some of the fashions, like, they don't really go all in and hammer you over the head with the fact that this is 70s. Like, you know, we get it, all right? Bell bottoms and that. But just because something was somewhat prevalent for the time doesn't mean you have to really go all in. So I like the kind of subdued nature of this film. And I like the dynamics, particularly between Enid and her parents, and especially as they're very compelling chats over the dinner table, and they're very sort of stiff upper lip and stoic parents, and the difficulty Enid has being able to describe what it is she actually does to her parents, and the fact that they ask her about her work on occasion, and there's a kind of a funny scene where they ask if there's anything she could recommend, and this is hardly the kind of role that it's not like she would be Siskel and Ebert giving a thumbs up to the kinds of dreck that Jeff and I have subjected ourselves to but really love. You know, it's not the kind of role. And so this is distributed by Vertigo Releasing, and it's got a little bit of a buzz, I think. And the visuals are really dynamite, and there, again, there are allusions to the kind of video interface that you see in the likes of Videodrome, especially when it comes to the white noise kind of pattern on the television. That's something we also saw in Lamberto Bava's Demons 2, where you have a demon coming out of the television, and you have, in the Videodrome, obviously, famously, James Woods is interfacing with this new technology, and Poltergeist probably put this notion on the map, although I don't know which one can rightly claim to having done it first. But this is an element that Censor brings out as well, because essentially what you have is Enid, being so consumed by her work that it consumes her. And this is a pretty great idea, and it's something that The Shining also delved into as well. So I thought it was a neat idea. And the conclusion is, I don't want to say it's unpredictable, but there's enough of a twist toward the end that I think it'll keep you guessing and keep you interested. But what actually drove me to this, of all things, would be its runtime, because I was getting really, especially after slogging through like 2.5 hours of Licorice Pizza. This is a film, I mean, I don't want to make the podcast about that, but Anderson is known for movies like Magnolia and Boogie Nights, and increasingly toward the latter part of his output, he's made movies that have just no structure or narrative whatsoever, and that was such a meandering, episodic film. And when I saw Censor coming in at a lean 84 minutes, I thought, okay, great, it's going to be pretty violent and lean type of movie. But there are stretches here, and this, you know, this calls to mind, I think, Saint Maud as well, where it has art house pretensions that don't do it any favors as well. And I think there could have been a little more fat trimmed, but that being said, I think it's still fairly lean. And I really like this horror director named Frederick North is fantastic, and he's actually kind of trying to bully this bureaucrat into reviewing one of his films. I think he has this agenda of maybe trying to create a buzz for it, as would have been the case for the time, for people seeking out movies that just ended up on this list. So it would have kind of defeat the purpose of having it when the classification board is just slaps this imprimatur on it. It would have called to mind what would have happened in the United States with Tipper Gore and putting messages on violent rap about killing cops and whatnot. People are probably familiar with the pretty funny testimony given against this notion by free speech advocates and very erudite and eloquent ones like Dee Snider from Twisted Sister and the legendary Frank Zappa. So, yeah, again, this North, finally, you know, he's making this film, and Enid stumbles onto the set, and the crew assume she's going to be an actress, and they put her in this very Argento-esque, flowing white gown. It almost calls to mind Phenomena with Jennifer Connelly, and obviously that awesome Donald Pleasance and his very, very awesome monkey. But yeah, she's wearing these diaphanous white dress, and she's sort of pulled into this production. And the blurring between movie reality and real reality is further blended by the kind of dreamlike quality this film has. And there are elements, I think, that called out the far superior, and one of my favorites, the stuntman, Peter O'Toole. So I like this kind of mixing of fact and fiction and chimerical dreamscapes and the realities of independent filmmaking, and setting it against the backdrop of this very interesting era. And you have the Thatcher economics and all this turmoil and hubbub happening in England at the time with the punk movement and all this this kind of panic. So it's an interesting time to host a horror film, and I think this one probably succeeds more than it fails, although can't help but notice once again the disparity, although not that great of a chasm, between the audience scores and the highfalutin high-minded critics. And you can't help but look at this film as something that critics will appreciate just because of the subject matter, and they may be just projecting and overinflating the numbers they give it. Really, I'm probably going to give it a solid 3 out of 5, and at this point, I think, speaking of pendulums swinging, I think I've gone too far toward newer type films, and I'm probably going to start going back to others from the, let's say, the golden era of horror. Is I was sort of mulling over in my mind a list of some of my favorite movie posters, and I was thinking definitely that Alice, Sweet Alice would be up there, because that's quite iconic, and maybe Popcorn or one of these other type of skull-type posters that brings to life, let's say, Fulci's The Psychic or one of these other types of things. I think City of the Living Dead also has a prominent skull, so I was thinking about that a little bit, and those are a couple films, Popcorn and Alice, Sweet Alice, that have been on my radar for a really long time, though I make no promises. I'll have to sort of see if I can track those down for the next episode of the podcast. Anyway, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.